Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. If I say the name Clint Hill, many of you won't know who I'm talking about, but give me about 20 more words here and you'll know pretty quickly. Clint Hill was a Secret Service agent who leaped onto the back of President Kennedy's limousine that fateful day in Dallas in 1963. Clint Hill's in the studio and he'll join us in about 60 seconds. Later on this hour, rock and roller Kelly Hunt. But first up, former Secret Service agent Clint Hill, who's out with a new book, 5 Days in November, which is a photographic look back at the assassination of President John F. Kennedy in 1963. And Clint Hill, welcome back to Up to Date. So good to have you here.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
When you were last here talking about exactly what you went through on that day in Dallas, Clint, I've got to tell you, you know, in some ways it's hard for me to ask you about what happened that day, just given how awful it was. How hard is it for you today to talk about that day?
Well, it actually became easier the more I did talk about it because it became rather cathartic to have it out there and be able to discuss it, get that emotional baggage out of my system.
You know, we focus so heavily on those moments when you were here in April of 2012. Listeners can listen to that conversation on our website at kcur.org. I'm wondering today about the aftermath of November 22nd, 1963. In your book, you talk about those exhausting days, and they were exhausting. I'm wondering when, if ever, did you have a chance to stop and really grieve about what happened that day and sort of process it and just take some time off to be alone with all those events that day?
Well, that really never did happen until I finally got out of an actual on-the-hands working situation and was given a desk job. And that happened in 1970. So that was 7 years after the event.
7 years later.
And then I thought about it so much that it really started to bother me emotionally, and that deterioration affected my physical condition over a period of time. And within 5 years from that point, I had deteriorated enough so that I was forced to retire.
What was happening to you, Clint?
Oh, everything. I kept thinking about what had happened, what I did, how could we have done something different? There was that sense of blame and guilt and responsibility that we failed to live up to that day. We failed to provide protection for the president. And that just ate me up. And I saw a series of doctors. I had many internal problems. Then by 75, when I did retire, then I had an interview with Mike Wallace on 60 Minutes, and I broke down on camera, and that kind of drove me deeper into an emotional abyss. And then I cut myself off from all my friends and my family. I secreted myself most of the time in my home in my basement, and I lived on scotch and cigarettes.
Let's listen to a clip from that interview with Mike Wallace back in 1975. Again, this was fully 12 years after the shooting.
Was there any way, was there anything that the Secret Service or that Clint Hill could have done to keep that from happening?
Clint Hill, yes.
Clint Hill, yes? What do you mean?
If he had reacted about 0.5 of a second faster, or maybe a second faster, I wouldn't be here today.
You mean you would have gotten there and you would have taken the shot?
The third shot, yes, sir.
And that would have been all right with you?
That would have been fine with me.
But you couldn't. You got there in less than 2 seconds, Clint. You couldn't have gotten there. You surely don't have any sense of guilt about that.
Yes, I certainly do. I have a great deal of guilt about that. Had I turned in a different direction, I'd have made it. It's my fault.
Oh. No one has ever suggested that for an instant. All that you did was show great bravery and great presence of mind. What was on the citation that was given you? For your work on November 22nd, 1963, extraordinary courage and heroic effort in the face of maximum danger.
Mike, I don't care about that. If I had reacted just a little bit quicker, I could have, I guess. And I'll live with that to my grave.
You know, Clint, I get the sense that even 12 years later, 1975, you really hadn't dealt with it yet. You really hadn't slowed down and said and gotten help for what happened that day.
Well, I didn't get help, and I really didn't do anything about it until 1990, another long period of time. And that's when I went back to Dallas. I walked the area of Dealey Plaza. I went up into the Texas School Book Depository to the sixth floor. Looked out that window. I examined everything, the angles, the weather, everything I could think of. And I finally came away with the conclusion that I had done everything I could that day. There wasn't much more I could have done. And so that did give me a sense of relief. Although I still feel that sense of failure. We didn't live up to our responsibility that day, and that's always bothered me and always will.
But that was 27 years later, Clint. 1990. You live with it. You were haunted by it for 27 years.
Yes, I was. And I should have gone back to Dealey Plaza much earlier. You know, we never discussed it among ourselves what happened in Dallas.
Because why? It was sort of a code among you guys didn't want to reveal very much about yourselves, right, to each other?
No, that wasn't that. It was that it was so painful to discuss. We had failed and it just hurt. And all the agents involved were the same. We didn't talk about it among ourselves. We didn't talk about it with our families or friends until 2009. At that time, a book was being written by a former agent who had left the service, and he had enlisted the aid of Lisa McCubbin, a writer, to help him.
Who's sitting right here with us in our studios this morning.
Yes. Yeah. And in that process, she contacted a number of the agents, including myself, and over a period of time, began to trust her and have confidence in her and started revealing what we saw, witnessed, what transpired that day. And that was very cathartic. And the more I talked to her about it, the better I felt. And that was the first time that any of us had really talked about it. And then they got us together in Dallas in 2010. They wanted to film a documentary. And so at that time, we all sat down together and talked about what had happened. That was the first time we had done that.
Yeah, I gather, looking back on it now, you wish you had spent some time talking about it prior to 1990, prior to 2009. Am I right?
Oh, yes, absolutely. The best thing that we could have done would have been to sit down and talk about it not too long after the event itself had occurred.
Hey, do you think you were suffering from PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder? Because, again, reading this new book you have out, 5 Days in November, again, the horror of that day comes through so clearly what you were forced to confront on a second's notice.
Yeah, I'm sure that it's similar to what the military personnel suffered when they come back from a war zone. It was post-traumatic stress disorder. And all of us went through it together. None of us received any counseling, and we all could have used it. And if, today, if something like that were to happen, I am sure that immediately there would be counseling and help for each and every one of the personnel involved.
Again, if you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date. We're visiting with former Secret Service agent Clint Hill about his new book, 5 Days in November. He was the agent who very famously and heroically leaped on the back of President Kennedy's limousine that day in Dallas when shots rang out. You know, Clint, as you go through this book and you look at all that you guys had to face, was there any mental health care available to the agents back in those days?
None whatsoever. There weren't many personnel within the organization at the time. One of the big problems was we didn't have anybody to replace us, and so we just continued to work, all of us. Two of us were assigned to Mrs. Kennedy, and we stayed there. There were three agents assigned to the children, and they stayed with the children for a time. But everybody else went to Johnson immediately because of the continuity of government. So nobody had any time off. Nobody had an opportunity to have any any counseling or to really grieve, for that matter, because we were all too busy.
And just to be crystal, Clint, on the cover of your new book, there's a photograph of President Kennedy and the First Lady just moments before the shots are fired. You are seen directly behind in the car behind them. In the photograph, you can see on the back of the president's limousine those sort of handles that were available for Secret Service agents. But you guys weren't on the back of the car because why?
The previous Monday, the president had been in Tampa, Florida. They had a 26-mile motorcade. The advance agent decided that rather than have the agents working the car all the way along the motorcade route on the ground, he would put two agents up on the back of the car in the position where the handholds and foot places standards are right built into the bumper. Well, about halfway through the motorcade, the crowd kind of dropped off. President Kennedy noticed that the agents were standing there, tapped the supervisor agent on the shoulder and told him, "Please, Floyd, will you get those Ivy League charlatans off the back of the car?" Now, we weren't too sure what he meant by charlatans, but we knew what he meant.
Nonetheless, you got the idea. Yeah.
So eventually they got off. And then at the end of the motorcade, he came to the supervisor and the advance agent and said, "Look, we're going into a political type situation where exposure is important. I can't have it seem like there's anything between the people and myself. And when the agents are up there in the back of the car, hovering over me, it gives the people the idea that there is a barrier between them and me. I can't afford that if I'm going to get reelected in 1964. So please don't have the agents up in the back of the car unless it's an absolute emergency."
And just to be clear, politically speaking, Kennedy was hurting in Dallas and in Texas at that time. Even though Vice President Johnson was on his ticket, he wasn't real strong in Texas. He wanted to make a good impression.
He wasn't strong in Texas. He wasn't strong throughout the South, and that was a big concern. They needed to carry a couple big states in the South in order to win re-election in 64, and they chose Florida and Texas because of the large number of electoral votes available in those two states, and that's why we went to Texas.
How much difference would it have made, Clint, if, in fact, two agents had been on the back of that car that day?
Well, the shooter would have probably had to have changed his plans because he would have either had to have shot as we approached the Texas School Book Depository, which means he would have been in front of us and we would have been fully aware of where the shots came from, or if he'd have waited until we made the turn and shot from the back like he eventually did, he would have, first of all, killed one of the agents on the right side where the president was standing or was seated, and then would have had a shot at the president, but we would have been in close proximity to cover him up, so we would have been able to cover and evacuate very quickly. So it would have been much to our advantage to have agents on the back of the car. But at the same time, at about the point where this event occurred, we would have gotten off the back of the car anyway because we were about to go under a triple underpass to get on a freeway, and we didn't want agents up in the back of the car at freeway speeds.
Mm-hmm. So you would have changed out anyway probably at that point.
At that point, we would have, yes.
Yeah. Well, you know, in the days and the weeks after all this happened, once you got through the funeral and all the dignitaries, did you sleep then, Clint, or was it just haunting you at that point?
Well, there was never any time to really rest. It haunted me because I stayed with Mrs. Kennedy and the children for a full year. And so I went through... We went up to Hinesport that Thanksgiving so she could talk to his parents. And then we came back to the White House and prepared for her to move out of the White House. She and the children moved out of the White House on December 6th, 1963. Then we planned to go to Florida for Christmas of 1963 and New Year's. And so we were always doing something. We were always busy. And, you know, you really didn't have a chance to really sit down and think about what happened. We were constantly on the go doing something, keeping very busy.
Did you and Mrs. Kennedy ever talk about it, Clint? Did you ever have a chance to sort of sit down with her and sort of process the events of that day, given how much time the two of you spent together?
That's one subject we never discussed. Never.
Really?
And she really didn't discuss it with anyone that I'm fully aware of. I think maybe she talked about it somewhat to her brother-in-law, but that was one topic she just avoided.
How about you talking about it with your own family? You said a while ago you didn't speak about it with the family, but even your wife, you didn't. She wasn't curious about, you know, what happened that day?
Never talked with them about it at all. Never. I had two sons and a wife, and I never talked about it with them. It was a subject we just never discussed.
Why?
It hurt too much. In fact, when in the process of assisting Lisa McCubbin in the writing of The Kennedy Detail, and then writing the two books, Mrs. Kennedy B and 5 Days in November, I went to a couple agents who nobody had really talked to, but were there in Dallas on November 22nd. Those two agents won't even talk about it with me. They just both said to me, it's just too painful. I just don't want to talk about it anymore.
Even then?
Ever.
Even then?
Yeah. It's just one of those things.
I should point out that Clint Hill and co-author Lisa McCubbin will be speaking tonight at 7 at Unity Temple on the Plaza. Call Rainy Day Books in Fairway to grab a ticket. That number, 913-384-3126. Clint, your new book, 5 Days in November, was interesting to me because, again, of the detail that you go into here in describing what happened that day. There was one moment that I had not known about, and it involved the autopsy of the president. It occurred back in Washington that night after the presidential party had returned from Dallas. Actually, it's early in the morning the next day, and you are asked to, I guess, one more time to view the president's body and listen to an explanation from a doctor because you were picked out because you were so close to Mrs. Kennedy, and you wanted to be prepared if there were any questions that she had about all of this. Describe what it was like for you, Clint, walking down that long hospital corridor and then walking into the room to see the president for that next moment there.
Well, when I got down there, there were two Secret Service agents in there. One of them was one of my supervisors, Roy Kellerman. And as I got to the door, he came out and he apologized to me for my having to do this because he knew this was going to be very emotional.
And it was crowded in that room when you walked through the door.
There were the two Secret Service agents, some FBI agents, a doctor. I believe Dr. Berkeley was there, who was Kennedy's personal physician. He was an admiral. And some other doctors were there. And they just showed me the wounds and showed me exactly what they had seen. And so that I'd be able to tell Mrs. Kennedy if she ever asked. She never asked. I never anticipated she would. But I knew that they wanted to make sure that if she did, someone was available to tell her, and I was the logical choice since I was closest to her.
Was that a good move to have you look at to view the body again, or looking back on it now, do you regret it?
I don't regret it. I think it was something that was necessary to do just in case, and better me than somebody else, I guess.
You know, today, Clint, when you think of President Kennedy, can you see him as we all see him, or do you see him in those darkest moments when you viewed him after he had died?
Both. The prominent one right now is, or has been, is him lying in the back seat of the car with his head on Mrs. Kennedy's lap with this hole in his right rear upper of his skull. But I also, when I think back, I think of the good times when he was with Mrs. Kennedy and the two children, either in Hyannisport or Palm Beach on one of the yachts out in the ocean, or out in Middleburg where the children and Mrs. Kennedy would enjoy riding horses, and he was enjoying watching them because he couldn't ride or anything because of his back problem.
Mm-hmm.
But he enjoyed being there and just there were friends that would come out and spend some time there with him. It was a chance to get away a little bit from the office.
But even today, 50 years later, you can still see him in the back of the limousine after the shots were fired.
That's the predominant picture I have in my mind because it was so gruesome and so final.
You know, on the day of the funeral, you learned that Mrs. Kennedy wanted to walk that entire processional route. What was your reaction to that?
Well, I knew that she, you know, once she made up her mind to do something, generally speaking,
she was going to do
she
it.
She was going to do it. There's not much.
She was a first lady, Clint.
Yeah. Well, she was. She had a mind of her own, really. But I also knew that she would listen to reason. And she ended up just walking from the White House to St. Matthew's, which was fine. I mean, it was a little over a mile, but that we could do. But the biggest problem was because of all the heads of state that were there. Because everybody knew that if she walked, they were going to walk too. They weren't going to, you know, drive in cars when Mrs. Kennedy was walking.
And for the service, that was an absolute nightmare, right? All this potential exposure right on your watch.
You know, it was a terrible situation security-wise. The Department of State Diplomatic Security Unit was responsible for heads of state at that time. And they had to call in everybody they could think of to help them. All other federal law enforcement agencies provided personnel. There were a number of personnel, but still it was extremely dangerous, extremely risky.
But you still, you managed to convince Mrs. Kennedy to sort of cut her walking route in half or even more than that, right?
Yeah, she ended up just walking from the White House to St. Matthew's, which was much less than walking the entire route. It would have been terrible if she'd walked all the way down Pennsylvania Avenue. So this was doable, but it was still very dangerous.
How long do you think she was in shock?
She was really in shock until we got back up on Air Force One. Leaving Dallas that day. We got on Air Force One, and she was in the back of the plane, seated in, near the casket. And back there with her were Kenny O'Donnell, the president's chief of staff, Dave Powers, one of the closest aides to the president, and Larry O'Brien. And she started to talk about what kind of a funeral arrangement she wanted to have.
She was already forward-thinking.
She was already thinking about what she should do next. First decision they had to make was where the autopsy was going to be. They had choices between Walter Reed Army Hospital, Bethesda Naval Hospital, George Washington University Hospital, and she selected Bethesda Naval Hospital because the president was a former naval officer.
Yeah. You know, I wanted to, speaking of that moment aboard the plane, did anyone, you know, close to the president ever sort of point a finger at you guys and say, where were you? Did you ever get that kind of accusation directed at you?
Not that I recall. I don't recall anybody ever saying that to me directly or indirectly.
But I'm thinking about the new film that's out. It's titled Parkland. Have you seen it by any chance?
I did see it.
Why did you go see it?
I was curious, and I thought that if I hadn't seen it, somebody would ask me a question. I better know that I had seen it.
Some talk show host in Kansas City would poke you with that question, right? Yeah. Well, the reason I ask about the finger pointing is there's a difficult scene in that film when a Secret Service agent with Kansas City connections, James Hostie, was sort of one of his supervisors looked at him and said, you know, you had the Oswald file on your desk and you didn't respond in a way that you should have. This is sort of on you, Mr. Hostie. And what about that? I mean,
he was not a Secret Service agent.
That's right. Okay.
He's with the FBI.
He's with the FBI. You're right. Thanks for the correction.
Yeah. They had a file on Hostie because
On Oswald, rather. Yeah.
Because Oswald had tried to defect to the Soviet Union. Well, he had defected, and he had to leave there. But that's the reason they had a file on him. And Hostie was apparently in contact with him on occasion and knew something about him. I don't think there was ever anything in any of Oswald's comments or any things that Hostie had that would indicate that Oswald had an interest in the president insofar as his being the person who would assassinate him.
Yeah.
So we never received any of that information from the FBI, but there was really never any reason for us to receive any.
You know, he lived in Kansas City. Did you ever meet him, talk to him about that?
I never met him. I knew that he did end up living here, but I've never met him.
Okay. Well, let's do this, Clint. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with former Secret Service agent Clint Hill, and we'll talk a little bit more about the events of the president's burial and how you accompanied Mrs. Kennedy and Robert Kennedy back up to the gravesite after the president was buried. And later on this hour, Kelly Hunt joins us. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR.
This is 89.3 FM, KCUR, online at kcur.org. Coming up in a half hour on Here and Now, a report on Missouri's efforts to woo Boeing to the Show Me State, plus big tech companies move to limit government surveillance of your online activities. Here and Now begins at noon and runs through 2. Tonight on Q, Oscar-winning actor Richard Dreyfuss. We also introduce you to the voice of Siri, the intelligent assistant for Apple products, plus hear about Black Peter, a controversial Santa helper. Q starts at 7. Up to Date is made possible in part by the Kansas City Women's Chorus inviting you to their holiday concert, I'll Be Home, December 14th at 8 and December 15th at 4 at the historic Folly Theater. Tickets are online at follytheater.org or at the Folly box office. And by the Financial Planning Association of Greater Kansas City, working to promote the profession by educating its members and by enhancing public awareness of the value of financial planning. Details and to find a financial planning professional online at fpakc.org. It's 11:32, 11 degrees. The wind chill factor makes it feel like zero. Partly sunny today. We'll have a high of 18. I'm Bill Anderson. We return you to Up to Date on KCUR and KCUR.org.
And we're back. I'm Steve Prasky. If you missed Friday's conversation with the DVD gurus about the journalists and how they appear on the silver screen, you can find that and more information on all of our broadcasts. Just go to kcur.org. Tomorrow on the program, need something to keep you warm on these cold days? Well, the book doctors will be in the house to discuss their favorite books of 2013. This hour, visiting with former Secret Service agent Clint Hill. He has a new book out with Lisa McCubbin. It's titled 5 Days in November. It recounts those moments from 50 years ago, the 5 days surrounding the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. You know, Clint, there's another moment that you write about on the night following the president's burial and the lighting of the eternal flame. Mrs. Kennedy asked you to take her and the president's brother Bobby back up to the cemetery late in the evening. Why?
Well, she wanted to go there privately, as much privacy as possible, not only to pay the respect to the president and her husband, but to see the eternal flame that she had requested.
It was her idea to do it. And people didn't think that it would be possible to pull it off, but they did. Yeah.
She made the request on the 24th, which was the day before the funeral, and they said it's impossible, they can't do it. And she persisted, and they did it. It was a little bit temporary arrangement, but it worked, and it's still there today.
Of course.
But that day, or that evening, she wanted to go there with Robert Kennedy, and she brought along some flowers. And Agent Landis and I took her up there. There was only a sentry there present. And she and Robert Kennedy knelt and prayed at the gravesite. And they spent about 10 minutes, maybe 12, 15. And then we went back to the White House. But that was the first time that she'd had the opportunity to be there almost completely alone.
And I gather it was dark, it was cold, and the cemetery was empty.
It was dark and it was cold, yes, the cemetery was empty. She noticed that there were some medals and green beret things that had been placed on the burial site, which were a tribute to the president, and she commented about that. Hmm.
You know, another event, John Kennedy's birthday came after, right on the tail end of these events, his third birthday, I should point out, and Mrs. Kennedy wasn't about to forget it. How did that come about, and when did it take place?
Well, that day, the day of the funeral, after the funeral, went back to the White House, and she had a reception for all of the visiting heads of state and heads of government who had come to pay their respects to the president. And when that concluded, she was ready to go up to the second floor residence. And I just mentioned to her, I said, Mrs. Kennedy, remember, this is John's third birthday. And she said, I won't forget that, Mr. Hill. She said, and she went upstairs, and they had a very small private family birthday for John. Only cousins and things of that nature were there. And they had a, you know, very subdued type birthday. And then they, later on December 5th, actually, they had a birthday celebration for both John and Caroline, because Caroline's birthday was November 27th. And so they didn't have an opportunity really to celebrate her birthday that week either. So on December 5th, they had a big birthday for John, Caroline, and they had all their classmates and friends in for that.
You know, I'm wondering, you know, Clint, as you witness these moments with the family, you know, the going up to Arlington on the night of the burial, and it's so quiet up there, and then sort of flipping directions so quickly and going to John's third birthday, and you're there, you're on duty, but did the emotions ever get to you at these different times, or were you constantly keeping those things in check?
You had to keep them in check because you didn't want the protectee, in this case Mrs. Kennedy, to witness you breaking down. You just couldn't afford to do that emotionally. So it was difficult. But and there were times, I know there's one photograph of me at the gravesite, and it's obvious that I was having a difficult time. But it was something you just had to restrain yourself from, allowing those emotions to take over.
You know, at John's third birthday, was he happy, or was he aware? Was he aware that something had happened to Dad, or was he not old enough to process it yet?
I don't think he fully processed it. He knew that there was something different, and that Daddy wasn't there. But I don't think he really understood the significance of it until probably later, after they left the White House and moved over to Georgetown.
Yeah,
I think then it became more aware that Daddy's not coming back.
Hey, how did the Secret Service change as a result of the Kennedy assassination? I mean, what happened after that in the manner in which the Secret Service protected presidents?
Well, it changed considerably, but it was very gradual. Immediately after that happened, they eliminated the use of an open car for the president, even in parade-type situations where they—
No more.
Yeah, they just couldn't do that anymore. Then they went through a period of complete reorganization. Names and titles were changed. And then they started to recruit additional personnel. They got authorization from Congress, and this was always the problem. Getting authorization from Congress to either expand or even to purchase new equipment or to do anything. And so they finally got some authorization from Congress, started to expand, to grow the base number of agents. They improved the training conditions for the agents, upgrade all the equipment, including modern technology. At that time, we were in the dark ages. I mean, we were using 3x5 cards and things of that nature. Mm. We didn't have any personal communications. So that all started to improve, but it was all gradual. I think in 1967, which would be 4 years after the assassination, was the largest recruiting year for agent personnel in the Secret Service. So you can see it took some time to get there.
You know, it's interesting to me with the way this country has protected its presidents over the years. I mean, we always seem to be behind the eight ball for so many years. Lincoln, and then Garfield, McKinley, and then, of course, you come to Kennedy. And you look back in hindsight, and there were clearly so many things that we should have been doing, even though we had been down this road before.
Well, it was always the case. And usually it was because you couldn't get the authorization from Congress to expend money. The only time you'd really get anything accomplished was after some event. Something would have to happen. I can recall we always wanted to upgrade the gates on the White House complex, the northwest, northeast, southeast, and southwest gates. We wanted them to prevent an automobile from going through them.
Yeah.
Well, they wouldn't give us the money and allow us to do it.
Wow.
Until Christmas Eve, 1971 or two, probably two, a guy crashed through one of the gates and got as far as the North Portico, and he had what appeared to be a bomb strapped to himself. Well, it turned out that it wasn't a bomb, and we were able to defuse the situation. But the next day,
wow,
it was authorized to improve the gate system.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of thing that went on all the time. Until you had some disaster happen, you weren't allowed to do anything.
What's your sense of today, Clint? Does the Secret Service have everything that it needs, or do you have a sense of that?
Well, they certainly have a great deal more than we had at that time. When the assassination occurred, we had about 330 agents. Today, they have an excess of 3,500.
Wow. Wow.
They have much better training by far than any of us ever had back in those days. They have much better equipment, and they are very up-to-date technologically. They have some of the best computer specialists in the world, some of the best information technology people. So that's really been a blessing that they have that capability.
I'm wondering about the price your family paid for all of this, for the shooting of the president, your own struggles to deal with it, Clint. What can you tell us about that?
Well, families pay a big price. I had two sons. My sons were about the same age as Caroline and John. I spent more time with Caroline and John than I did with my own sons. And so my sons grew up without a father for all intents and purposes. Their mother just took care of everything. And so we were distant. And now I am closer with my sons than I've ever been. Hmm. And they are fully grown and they have children of their own. My wife and I are no longer together. But all of that is because of really what happened way back then. It was extremely difficult to maintain family life because you were gone almost all the time. I thought originally I was gone about 80% of the time. But after researching the books and doing everything, I found out I was gone almost 90% of the time. So, I mean, you can see it's not very beneficial for a family.
You know, Clint, after you served the Kennedys, you went on to serve President Johnson. You became the special agent in charge of presidential protection. When Richard Nixon came into office, you protected Vice President Agnew. And finally, you were assigned to headquarters as the assistant director of the Secret Service for All Protection. Did you ever develop the same affinity you had for the Kennedys with the other presidents that you wound up working for?
Well, I had a very close relationship with almost every protectee I was involved with. President Johnson, initially, our relationship was very strained because he knew I had been with the Kennedys.
You were a Kennedy guy, and he
thought of that.
A lot of difficulty between the two.
But by the midterm of his, about 1965, 66, it started to really change. And by 1967, I was placed in charge of his protection. And in 1969, when he was about to leave office, he called me into the Oval Office and wanted to know if I'd be willing to be the agent in charge of his protective detail at the Pedernales River Ranch, the LBJ Ranch in Texas. And I told him I didn't think my career path went along the banks of the Pedernales River, but he agreed.
Yeah.
And then I was very close with Vice President Agnew, and I was somewhat close with everybody else. I wasn't close with President Nixon because at that time I was in headquarters and I didn't have any day-to-day contact with anybody in that administration except for, I had some confrontations with Haldeman and Ehrlichman and those people. But
is that right? What a shock that is. We just screened a special viewing of All the President's Men last night in connection with our station just last night and hadn't seen that movie on the big screen in a number of years. And I can only imagine you had some difficulties with those two guys.
It's a great movie.
Yeah, it is a great movie. Well, again, Clint Hill, you can see and hear him this evening with his co-author, Lisa McCoven. They'll be together at 7 this evening at Unity Temple on the Plaza. Call Rainy Day Books in Fairway to grab a ticket. That number, 913-384-3126. And Clint, so glad you're doing better with all this stuff, and it's such a pleasure to have you here.
Thanks. It's very, very nice to be back in Kansas City. Thank you for having us on,
Steve. You bet. Again, that's former Secret Service agent Clint Hill.